So memory of the Quran is an interesting feature of Islamic life. And you'll find that people are venerated as a result of their ability to absorb as much as possible. Wow, isn't that an interesting challenge for us to recognize that this particular religion encourages its people to memorize as much of the Quran as possible. I hope some of you have been in settings where you have been encouraged to memorize bodies of scripture. It truly is an amazing task to do. Have any of you memorized a full chapter or full book of the Bible? Memorized a full book of the Bible? Anybody done that? Love to honor you if you have memorized any book, even a short one, Titus, you know, something short. But have any of you done that? How many of you have memorized a chapter, a full chapter? I work Psalms all the time. You hope you memorized a whole chapter in the Psalms. My mom made sure I memorized all those. And I hope you've all memorized a verse. So you can.
I've got a beautiful doll, which I still have.
Yes.
When I was about 12, my grandmother felt that Psalm 91 is a psalm of protection.
Oh.
And that was her little prize if my sister and I would learn it. Mm-hmm. We'd get these beautiful dolls at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And we did. And they were kept quite well because they're a little bit old for dolls, but we more did it to honor my grandmother.
Honor?
But I thank her for that.
And it hasn't disappeared, has it?
No.
The memory of that is a permanent memory. Isn't that neat? And so I sort of enjoy reflecting on the intensity of Islamic thought when it comes to memory. This is a people that typically are less literate than we are. And so memory becomes the key feature of their educational opportunities. And often their imams or their teachers are religious, and therefore the books that they use are religious. It's not much different than the Puritan text. If you look at Puritan texts in the 1600s, you'll see that those are incredibly religious. And that carried America right through almost into the 1940s and 50s in lots of settings, where an awful lot of the education was very, very religious, and memory of the Bible would occur. But this is an interesting and a key ongoing feature of Islam. Is memory of the text. Question?
Well, I certainly understand the value of memorizing those things which stay deep in your heart, even if I can't remember the exact words at the age of the old. But I'm wondering if in Islam there is also a veneration for those folks who are able to integrate the various parts. We, I think, appreciate those who don't like proof texting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they have a culture about
that? What I can speak to is far, far less tolerance for discerning what could be even considered errors in the text. As opposed, you have a very nice way of collecting, when you're dealing with a topic, it's nice to collect the various passages that relate to the topic to create a coherent structure. And I think that can be done well within any religious tradition, and you'll see that. It's a bit like our Jesus conversation when they collected that. And if that's done well, that's fine. What Islam doesn't have a lot of tolerance for are to discern what any of the issues or problems in the text. They have far less. So that if we're reading a text and we see that Jesus got out of the boat in Mark, and he got out of the boat at one place, and we go into Matthew, and Jesus got out of the boat, and he's in a different place, and that sure seemed like the same story to you. And you sort of look at that and go, wow, what's happening with these two things? Within Islam, it's really, really deeply frowned upon. Whereas in Christianity for the last few hundred years, we've sort of used that as a teaching technique to sort of look at the distinctions and differences within the text. Ooh, I would think they would argue that it is the scholars that are creating divisions by asking those questions. And so that would be a lovely conversation, but I would wonder. We have really created Christian maturity by working Christians through. That's really a seminary education, is handling all of those issues. We tend not to bring a lot of those issues into the church because it gets a little confusing for folks. But in seminaries, that's pretty well, you know, our seminary life is working through all of these various textual issues that come up. That's just anathematized within Islam. And you don't do that. And I find that fascinating because I'm reading an exquisite book on the origins of the Quran. I sent it around last time. I don't think I brought it because I'm reading it. And it is a text that's doing exactly that, taking all of the textual material of all of the various different Qurans that are available, and there's six bodies of Quranic thought. And they are comparing and contrasting them, trying to understand where all these stories, all the same questions you folks have been asking me. You know, my goodness, why, you know, when you read it, why does this, you know, do this or what? There are the natural questions that people bring to a text. And it's quite fascinating that is as rare as it is in Islam. But it will be happening more and more because of the internet, because of the ability to do it without repercussions that are as dramatic if you're holding close to your faith. The other issue that we have in Christianity that you don't have in Islam as much is language translations. And when you can hold to one language, and the Quran will be written in Arabic, and you are expected to know it in Arabic, and you are expected to memorize it in Arabic. And that unity that comes from a singular language is as important to them as Latin was to the church. And for so long, you had to know Latin to understand the theology of the church, because everything had been built up in the language of Latin. And the shift away from Latin is still reverberating throughout the church. Why? Because you have learned the faith in a new language. And that gives you new ways of seeing it and creates another layer of questions as to how things are translated within your particular language group. And if you've studied other languages, you know it's really hard to translate ideas from one language to another. And that's clearly an issue from the perspective of the translators for that migration. But I counter that particular point by saying, but that was the miracle of Pentecost. Are we coming up on Pentecost? It's pretty close, isn't it? Is it next Sunday or a couple Sundays? That's the miracle of Pentecost. And Christianity has been built on the ability of language transmission, where you can take from one language base and migrate it to a brand new language, and that there is the expectation that the Holy Spirit will facilitate that. And that is the entire tradition within Christianity. Well, in Islam, the reverse will be true. The expectation is that you must learn Arabic, and you hold to that. And that keeps unity much stronger within the religion. You get less problems that way. And that's part of the success of Islam, is holding their text tight. Whereas a lot of our problems and a lot of differences, I mean, one of the huge differences between Orthodox Christianity and Jehovah's Witness is we put capitals on Holy Spirit and they won't put capitals on Holy Spirit. And you can't imagine how important that is to those two traditions. And that literally capitalization. And so those are all issues that translators had to deal with as they were moving text into language. And so those kinds of issues you don't find as dramatically within Islam, and therefore you can have a much closer control on your text.
Well, you can see me wanting to ask just one more.
Okay.
And Christian seminaries do have some dialogue sometimes over some of the Hebrew texts.
Mm-hmm.
But is it true that some of our origins for the Old Testament are in Aramaic?
I have never encountered an Aramaic text, though I know they exist. Because we're talking about texts and languages, we think that Paul was carrying 14 different books in his backpack. Different languages. We can see little vignettes and particles in his letters because it's so natural that as you are writing a people group, you will use the text that allows you to communicate. And we wonder if he didn't have something like an Aramaic text that he was working. We don't, we're nervous on that. We know he had Syriac, and we know that he had, you know, there's a lot of the languages that he was encountering as he did his missionary. It would make sense that he would have some documents of something that he could write to. And so the Christians have had to deal with this problem. How do I write the message into a new people group with a new language? And that's pretty normal for all of our missionaries. And now it's pretty normal for Portland that we've got to do the same thing whenever we're moving from one to the other. And so one more question on history that we talked about last time. We'll get there in a second. When I bring that one up, we'll.
Okay, but you're telling us that the Quran is taught in Indonesia in Arabic.
The purists will always want, this is what we can say with any religion, the purists will always want, within Islam, will want the text taught in Arabic. But there's the clear recognition that the language I've got an English translation right here. So clearly, there has been the move to translate it into many other languages.
I can't imagine
Yeah. So that becomes an issue, and it is successful because it is being presented in the languages of the people group. But the underlying is not as within Christianity. It's very easy to jump people groups. It's much more difficult with Islam because of the Arabic demand by at least their scholars and their elites that are working on the text. They must know Arabic, and that's a fascinating challenge for any scholar to get that language up and running. Okay. We have an announcement. Let's do that now.
Just a quick request. Those of us who are on the Adult Christian Education Committee have been asked to consider moving our Growing in the Grove classes off of Wednesday nights. So we're trying to determine, does that work for people? Does that not work for people? As you know, Pastor Bob has his class on Wednesday nights, and we've had others, and Dr. Williams has been gracious enough to change his schedule for Wednesday night as well. So I'm going to pass around just a tally sheet. You don't need names, but if you'd be so good just to mark, can you come on Monday night, and or Wednesday night, and or Thursday night, or our options, and then we'll start collecting some data.
So if you come all three,
just check all three.
Thank you. And I have an important amendment to my schedule. I have the great joy of my middle son, Austin, graduating from high school on May 30th. May 30th is a Wednesday night. Guess where I am currently scheduled to be on May 30th? Guess which one of my sons is not happy with me? And so I did ask the council to see if there's any suggestions on changes. And the suggestion that seemed to be the most successful is simply to delay the last lecture, May 30th, by 1 week. And I'm thrilled to come back and close it off. And if you could somehow remember that will happen, and so that I won't embarrass you or you will embarrass yourself, or something will happen and you show up and no one else is here. If you can remember that the May 30th night will not be on Islam. So if anyone else has any other projects, it won't be on Islam. It might be a good night to get everybody together and have a conversation. They might all show. But for me, I won't be here on May 30th. And it's June the 6th? That's okay. So June 6th. And if there might be an announcement in the bulletin just for people that might catch this, is there any way to put an adjustment into the bulletin? Because there would probably be a half a dozen or so folks that have been coming just from the amount of seats that I typically see. So if that were possible, that would be wonderful. Thank you. And now my middle son can graduate with his father in attendance. You know how important that is to high schoolers. Oh, my goodness.
And to their daddies.
And to their dads. We're very proud of them. That's right. Last time we talked about Muhammad, and we talked about his children. This is quiz time, folks. What do you remember about his children? How many did he have? Two. And they died in infancy. Now, what is the immediate problem that's going to come from that particular issue? If you were in a leader in a corporation, and you were in a tradition where the sons had been the heirs of the corporation, what problem do you now have? Succession is a mess. And our culture has gotten past that by finally allowing women to be much more involved in the leadership of the organizations. But in this traditional setting, that was not acceptable. And the daughters had influence into some of the successors. But the dilemma is that he did not designate a successor, which means someone else will, to keep the organization moving forward. The first four successors were considered caliphs. A caliph is more of the language of the Sunni tradition, and the caliph is a bit of a CEO and clergy. And so, if we're talking about the integration of the mosque and the state, if we're talking about the integration of Islam and the governmental levers of power, then these individuals are now the mayor and the pastor, and that's being woven into the organizational structure of Islam. And so, can you think of the problems that come when, in your language, church and state are woven together? What's the difficulty there that you might want to consider, because those are the same issues that Islam is dealing with when they have the CEO and the clergy being woven together? What are the issues? So what are some of the strengths of that? When you have them woven together, what's some of the strengths organizationally? You get better unity, don't you? Yeah? Unity. What else? Yeah, once you get the purpose established, boy, you're singular in your approach to it. Very, very helpful. What are some of the other strengths? Why is this good to have the mayor and the pastor, or the CEO and the clergy, woven in a city structure? Exactly. When you're constructing your laws, your values, and your moral structure, it's easy to weave them together. And it's important in a lot of ways for that to happen. Any other strengths that you can think about of having the clergy and the CEO woven together?
Consistency.
Yes. There can be tremendous inconsistency if you don't do it. And there can be conflict. And so if you have unity, you have that. The other element is you have all of the levers of power available to you. If you have the lever of power that's spiritual, if you do that, that's a sin. Don't do that. Or, and that's your spiritual side. Can you imagine if you could match that with, if you do that, I'll cut off your head, because I've got the ability to do that. Or I'll have a soldier do that. Or I'll have the army do that. If you have also the levers of power of the army, you have dramatically higher abilities of generating power. You can see the struggle that the Pope is currently having, because he's frustrated that some of the politicians in Brazil are organizing, are approving abortion. And so he's flinging out the excommunication power that he has, trying to get these politicians not to approve abortion. Well, if he still had a papal army, then he could send that into Brazil. And we don't do that anymore, do we? But it is a tool. It is a tool that when you merge church and state, you have the opportunity of using all of the levers of power that are available in a social construction. So it's important to realize that, because those are integrating within Islam.
I'm sorry. I have personally difficulty seeing the things that you are calling strengths as strengths, because to me, they look like weaknesses.
Fair enough. What are the weaknesses when you integrate church and state? What are the weaknesses when you integrate your mayor and your pastor? What are the weaknesses when you integrate the CEO and the clergy?
You diminish that personnel freedoms
or personal choice. Okay, personal choice is eroded.
Mm-hmm. Church is mandatory.
Church becomes mandatory. Yes, you have so much power, you can impose that structure very effectively. onto the community. Uh-huh.
The main thing, when you do this, you absolutely limit or even cut off any discussion. There's no learning taking place. It's just this way or nothing.
There you risk that. You have so much power that you can do that. And so that becomes a serious issue, is your ability to have, when you have that much power, what are you going to do with it? And it can turn dictatorial or tyrannical very, very quickly.
It also can be a positive educational.
Very much.
You will go to school.
That's right. You
will learn the catechism.
Very well.
And you may not want it, but it will strengthen you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, if you place them side by side, they can sort of keep each other healthy. The dilemma when there's no checks and balances is it can get unhealthy, and you don't know how to control it sometimes. And so the key control typically then is the one source of unity. And we can see that in early American thought. They would always defer to the Bible. And if the Bible was, if the Bible said it, then they did it. And even the mayor and the pastor could organize around that unity around reading of the text. The same thing happens within Islam. And so that makes the Quran very important, so that when you have diversity, you come back to the centralizing text, and that allows you to decide if it's the right thing to do. And so the Quran becomes very important in a setting like this, trying to keep a check and balance system so that people don't run off on their own and do things because they feel like it.
Well, I think you see the problem in Islam with this, because what I've understood is that in the Quran you have contradictions, and the problem is you have somebody that's strongly militant will take on the, exterminate the infidel, they'll focus on that, and no thought process takes place, and the other side says, well, make it a personal spiritual test quest, and they'll focus on that, and the two conflict.
The key, though, is a Muslim would never admit to contradictions in the Quran. Never. It goes back to our conversation on the inability of the scholars to do the kind of historical checks that we've been doing in Christianity for 300 years. It just doesn't happen within Quranic scholarship. And that makes it very, very challenging for you to have conversations on what you might consider contradictions, because de facto it cannot happen in the conversation or the language of Islam. It just cannot happen. And so that becomes the dilemma of the conversation. There is that expectation that it can happen within a Christian setting. There is the expectation you cannot go there within a Muslim setting. It is the expectation and it's the assumption that that's your problem, not the Quran's problem. The Quran becomes an eternal text that is consistent, and therefore it is internally consistent. If you think you see inconsistencies, that remains your problem, not the text. You see how that has to be interpreted that way?
That's crazy.
Well, but we all do it. In every religion with our own texts. We tend to do that. And that's the challenge of sacred literature, is how we read it. And you can have very, very strict reading codes as you come to the text. You can have very sloppy reading codes when you come to the text. And that's the challenge. Within Islam, all we can say is very strict reading codes with no assumption at all that there's going to be contradictions. And so you come to the text and you read it that way. And that shapes how you see the text. So it's important that you put yourself in the mind of a Muslim as they come to the text. And that allows you to understand the way that they read their text. And that's important for us. So that we come to a conversation with a Muslim, you have that knowledge of what is happening with their reading of the text. Oh no, top ten. Yeah, that was a precept of Muhammad, that there will be no contradictions in the text. There just won't be. And so scholars really struggle on this grant. I'm sorry I didn't bring the book I'm reading, because it's just such a rare book, and it's so beautifully done on the Quranic issues, you know, the multiple sources. This person brought it in this way, and this time it came in that way, and all the wonderful issues that scholars such as myself just enjoy dabbling in. Well, that's just like hot potatoes that you don't touch within a traditional Muslim community, and you don't go there as far as that kind of conversation with a Muslim. And we just have to accept that, folks. You might disagree, you literally just have to accept that as you understand the way they see their world. And that's really our objective tonight, is how do they see their world? And there's going to be lots of things tonight you're going to disagree with, but all we can say is that's the way they see their world. And the minute you know that, you can build a bridge. You can build a bridge. As long as you understand the way a person sees the world, you can build a bridge to that. And you can have conversations with that. And that's why it becomes very fascinating to understand how they structure their lives. And many of the issues we're going to deal with are completely different than how Christians see their world. But if they know how you see the world and you know how they see the world, there's a bridge that can go up in the middle. And you can have conversations by understanding the assumptions. If you don't know the assumptions, you have no idea of how to converse. And I think the great need of our community of America is, how do we talk? Because if we cannot talk, we are restricted to other activities, and that might lead to fighting. And we do not want to go there. We just don't want to go there. And so that becomes so, so important. And so the key, when you have the integration of church and state, you have the ability, you have the control of the army. And with the control of the army, you can use that army. And if Arabia is in disarray with tribes that are localized, multiple languages, multiple centers of power, you can begin to expand. And so my map isn't quite as good as I would like on its coloration. But from the death of Muhammad to 750 is the dark area here. And you can see the expansion of the dark area. So there's a tremendous amount of expansion of Islam into that time. Remember, 750 CE, boy, not a big period as far as significant empires around the world. That was what we called what in Christianity, which is an incorrect phrase, but it's what we use to define 750 CE. What do we call that in the history many of us have learned together? The Dark Ages. Boy, I dislike that. I would encourage every one of you to read The Victory of Reason, a brand new text just come out by Rodney Stark. What his thesis is, I am going to dispute that this was the Dark Ages for Christianity. And he just lays out everything Christians did all the way through this period and just decimates the argument, which really is the argument of the Enlightenment, that the church was wrong, the church was in control, everything was miserable, and we didn't do anything but sit in our villages and turn into a mess all the way through this time. It's a miserable argument that needed to be refuted. It has been very successfully refuted within the last year. And so that's The Victory of Reason. The point is, there isn't any successful world empire that's competing here. All the competition, you can see where it stops. The Chinese are very, very strong, so it's not moving into China. And the Chinese closure and the forbiddenness of the Chinese is also going to stop Islam. So that becomes an important issue. The next part of the graph is, how far did Islam spread up until 1500? And that's all the dark areas. And you can see how far it spread. How close to Paris was Islam? How close to Paris?
200-300 miles?
At best. I think it's less than 200 somewhere, 150, 170. Islam was with, and Paris was one of the centers of Christian thought, was one of the centers. Look at how it's going. I'm fascinated with how far it spread. And I ask that to say, what was the most significant event of 1492? On the worldwide stage, What was the most significant event of 1492? You're getting close. You're getting close. Spanish Inquisition was in the 13 to 1400s. You're right. But 1492. Most important event. The Moors were kicked out of Spain. 1492. And so the Islam was rid from being so close to Paris. That was what was happening. But what was also happening is that the knowledge base of Islam was coming back. As we've talked about, Islam is very, very centered on knowledge. Why? Because the entire culture that this is built on is centered on knowledge. We'll see that in some theoretical ways here. But that knowledge has been protected. Babylon, as we have talked about, is the largest library in the history of the world. Genghis Khan was the one that blew that one down in the 1300s, if memory serves me right. And so the knowledge is there. Aristotle, we know to this day because it was in the Library of Babylon. And Aristotle came into our universities in Europe from Islamic sources. And so many of us have been trained in Aristotle. And that was the only place we know that they had copies of Aristotle. All the other copies seemed to disappear. But they were kept in Babylon. That knowledge spread with their armies. And now an awful lot of this, my goodness, you know, you're getting a tremendous amount of desert. You know, it isn't hard to control this area when you're a desert people. But isn't it interesting how far throughout India and into right into what we now know as Russia? Where are the central conflicts in the world today? Where are the central conflicts in the world today? Tell me about a few of them. Okay, how about Pakistan? Okay, so Pakistan. What